council following in the south. I am frightened by all of it. There is no room for a wrong decision now. You will do what is best, she said. I have faith in you. Oh, I have faith in myself, Meg. But all men make mistakes.
Margaret always says you are as cunning as a fox, and trying to outthink you was like catching wood smoke with your fingers.
He grinned and the tension fell from him, though the fatigue remained. I will feel better when the clan women and children are safe, and my thoughts can turn once more to simple tasks, like killing the Anir.
You think that will be more simple?
Indeed it will. They think they have won. They see us running and believe us broken. That we will turn and they will find themselves staring into the tawny eyes of the killing wolf.
She turned to him, staring up into his angry eyes.
You will not let hate enter your soul.
No, do not fear for me in that way.
I do not hate the Anir. They are what they are. No more do I hate the mountain lion who hunts my cattle. And yet I will fight and kill the lion.
Good.
Hate would not sit well with you, Caswallon of the Farlan.
How could I hold you in my heart and find room for hate?
He said, kissing her lips.
Now you must go, for I have much to do.
Hitching up her skirt, she ran along the column, found the warrior holding Donal, and thanked him for his help. The child was still sleeping, and she took him back in her arms and walked on. Caswallon wandered to the rear of the column, where Leofas walked with a rear guard. Surrounded by younger men, the burly warrior seemed grizzled and ancient, but his eyes shone as Caswallon approached.
"Well, we made it without incident," he said.
"It looks that way,"
Caswallon agreed.
Leofas scratched his beard. There was more grey than red in the hair, and Caswallon thought it had the look of rust on iron.
Leofas was old, but he was tough and canny, and the day had not dawned when an enemy could take him lightly.
He wore a glistening mail shirt of iron rings, sewn to a leather base with silver thread. By his side were two short swords, and in his hand an iron-capped quarterstaff.
"Do you mean what you said, Caswallon, about sending our people through the Druid's Gate?"
"Yes."
"Will they be safe?"
"Safer than here, my friend, believe me. 100 of the older men will go with them, to help with the hunting and building."
"And then what?" "Then you and I will hunt a different game."
The older man's eyes gleamed and he grinned wolfishly.
"It's about time. I do not feel right heading away from the devils. My legs keep turning me about. I never thought the day would come when I'd care about what happened to the Palladies,"
Leofas went on. "But I hope that old wolf Margrig is safe.
He's not a man to be surprised by a sudden attack. He would have scouts out."
"Yes, but so did we, Caswallon."
40 miles to the south and east, Magrig's anger was mounting. He was tired of being herded towards the west, tired of skulking away from the enemy and filled with a sense of dread. The Anir had caught up with them on the afternoon of the day following the attack, but Paladin's scouts had hit them with a storm of arrows and slowed their pursuit. Since then, they had outflanked the clan to the east, and the two groups were seemingly engaged in a deadly race, the Anir endeavouring to outrun them and prevent the northward exodus. Rare cunning and an intimate knowledge of the land enabled Magrig to stay ahead, but always the angle of the march was being shifted, and the wily Paladin's hunt lord had begun to suspect they were being herded west for a reason other than the obvious. It had seemed at first that the Anir commander wanted to force a direct battle by cutting off their flight, but he had spurned two opportunities so to do. Once could have been put down to ignorance or lack of thought. Twice was a different tale. As the swordsman Intosh had pointed out, it could still be stupidity. Magrig had grunted, dismissing the idea.
"Any general who needs to rely on his opponent being an idiot is in sore trouble. No, I don't think he wants a confrontation yet. I think there's another Anir force to the west of us. We are between a hammer and a hard rock." "We have limited choices,"
said Intosh, squatting to the earth and sketching a rough map of the terrain ahead.
"All we can do is react. We are hampered by the presence of our women and children."
"According to our scouts," said Magrig, "the enemy has 2,000 men. We have 800 who can fight, and 700 women. With older children who can handle a bow, we could muster 1,600 fighters."
"To what purpose?"
said Intosh.
"We cannot take them on."
"We must,"
said Magrig sadly.
"Yes, we can continue to run, but each mile brings us closer to disaster. We must take the initiative."
"We cannot win."
"Then we'll die, my friend, and we'll take as many of the swine along the path as we can."
Intosh's eyes focused on Magrig. The swordsman was also tired of running.
"It is your decision, and I will stand by you. But where do we make this stand?"
Magrig knelt beside him, and together they selected the battle site, tracing the lines of the land in the soft earth. Dawn found the Aenir under Ongist, marching through a wide valley. Ahead was a range of hills thickly wooded with ancient oaks on the left slope, and to the east a higher hill clear of trees. Upon that hill was the shield ring of the Pallides, the rising sun glistening on the sword, spears and helms of the clan, and shining into the eyes of the Aenir. Ongist called his scouts to him.
"How long before Barca reaches us?"
"Another day," said a lean, rangy forester. "Do we wait?" Ongist considered it. To wait would mean sharing the glory, and the women. Shading his eyes, he scanned the hill, making a rapid count.
"How many would you think?"
The forester shrugged his shoulders. 1,500, maybe 2,000, but half of them must be women. Vatin's bulls, Ongist, we outnumber them by 3 to 1. Drada had been insistent that no major battle should be joined until Barca's troops had linked with his. But what would father say if Aenir warriors merely waited, apparently fearful of attacking a hill defended by women, old men, children, and a handful of warriors? Calling his captains forward, Ongist ordered the advance. The Aenir swept forward, screaming their battle cries and racing towards the hill. The slope was steep, and arrows and spears hurtled amongst them, but the charge continued. On the hilltop, Magrig drew his sword, settling his shield firmly in place on his left arm. The Aenir were halfway up the hill, the last of their warriors on the lower slopes, when Magrig gave the signal to the warrior beside him. The man lifted his horn to his lips and let sound the war call of the Pallides. In the woods behind the Aenir, 800 women dropped from the trees, notching arrows to the bowstrings. Silently they ran from cover, kneeling at the foot of the slope and bending their bows. The Aenir warriors, running with their shields before them, were struck down in their scores as black-shafted death hissed from behind. Ongist, at the centre of the mass, turned as the screams began. Hundreds of his men were down. Others had turned to protect themselves from this new assault. These only succeeded in showing their backs to the archers above. Ongist cursed, and ducked as an arrow flew by him to bury itself in the neck of his nearest companion. The charge had faltered. He had but one chance of victory, and that lay in charging the women archers below. He bellowed for his men to follow him, and he began to run. But at that moment, Magrig sounded the horn once more, and the shield ring split as he led his fighters in a reckless attack on the enemy rear. Intosh beside him, the burly hunt lord cut and thrust his way into the Aenir pack. A sword nicked his cheek before the wielder fell with his throat opened to be trampled by the milling mass. Shaft upon shaft hammered into the Aenir ranks. Death was ahead of them, and behind they could hear the shrill battle cry of the Pallides. Cut, cut, cut! Faced with a hail of missiles, many of the Aenir broke to the left, streaming away towards the safety of the trees, desperate to be clear of the rain of death. Ongist was furious. With a hard core of his personal carles, he stood his ground, but the battle was lost. Arrows tore into his men, opening a gap in the shield wall, exposing Ongist to the enemy. Two shafts pierced the air, ripping into Ongist's chest. With a grunt of pain, he broke off the jutting shafts, turning. Ongi saw Magrig before him, his beard dark with blood, his eyes gleaming and his lips drawn back from his teeth in a feral snarl. Ongist lashed out weakly. Magrig parried the blow with ease, lifting his hand for the archers to cease shooting. Ongist, the last Aenir alive, staggered, then gazed on the enemy with new eyes. His legs buckled, and he fell to the ground, pushing himself to his knees with great effort.
"Brengham,"
muttered Magrig, walking past the dying Aenir general, and on towards the trees. Within the hour, the Palades were once more marching north and west. Behind them the crows settled on the Aenir dead. More than 1,100 bodies, stripped of armour and weapons, littered the hillside. And nailed to a tree, hung the body of Ongist, his ribs splayed grotesquely, his innards held in place with strips of wood. His eyes had been put out, and his tongue torn from his mouth. Magrig also knew the Aenir dream of Valhalla. Ongist's shade would neither speak nor see as it was led to the grey god's hall. Galen and Diva scrambled over the last skyline before Atophos, staring out at the great falls and the spreading forests, the wide valleys and the narrow rocky passes beyond. In the distance, he could just make out the moving column, like ants crawling across a green blanket. He sank to the ground beside Diva. He was tired now, but she was exhausted. Her moccasins cut to rags by the flinty rock and the scree slopes. Her feet were bleeding, and her face was grey with fatigue. Her golden hair, once so beautiful, hung in greasy rat's tails to her grimy neck. She laid her head against his neck. "Did not think we'd get here safely," she said. He stroked her hair, saying nothing. Beside them, Renda spread himself out, resting his head on his paws. He had not eaten for 2 days, and gone was the sleek shine of his fur. 3 times they had dodged their pursuers, hiding in caves and beneath thick bushes, and once sheltering in the branches of a broad oak as the Aenir searched beneath. 2 times they had stumbled on the tortured bodies of clansmen nailed to trees and splayed in the horrifying blood eagle. Diva had wanted the bodies cut down, but Galen refused, pointing out that such an action would only alert the trackers. Now they were clear, with only an hour's gentle downhill stroll to meet with the clan. Galen rubbed his sweat-streaked face, scratching idly at the jagged white scar above the blood-filled left eye. He scanned the falls and the rushing white water, then transferred his gaze to the column as it moved with painful lack of speed towards the woods. Suddenly, Galen jerked as if stung. From his vantage point, he could see into the trees, and just for a moment, he caught a glimpse of a warrior, running, bent over. The man had been wearing the horned helm of the Aenir.
"Oh, no," he whispered. "Oh, gods, no!"
"What is it?" asked Diva, swinging her head to glance back down the trail, expecting to see their pursuers close by.
"The Aenir are in the woods," he said. "They're waiting to hit the clan, and I can't warn them."
Diva shaded her eyes, searching the timberline. "I see nothing. It was only one man, but I know there were more." Despair washed over the young man. "Let's move," he said, and they began to run down the grassy slopes, angling away from the woods. Far below them, Caswellan halted the column. Ahead was the forest of Atta, the dark and holy place of the Druids. Beyond that, according to Taliesin, was the invisible bridge to Valen. Caswellan called Leofas to him, and Bordric, who had returned from the west with news that the Aenir had split into several forces, the majority racing east at speed, the others vanishing into the mountains in small groups. The scouting party had cornered 20 Aenir warriors and destroyed them, taking one alive whom they questioned at length. He would tell them little save that they had been pursuing a man and a girl. Bordric killed the man swiftly and led his party back to Caswellan.
"What do you think?"
asked Bordrigg.
Galen? It could be. The girl might be Deva. Derek's scouts found the mutilated body of a clan girl they thought was Lorraine, and Agwain said the two girls were together. Why would the Anir split their forces? Leofas asked. I would bet it's Magrig. The wily old fox is probably leading them a merry dance.
Taliesin joined them, leaning on his oak staff, his long white hair billowing in the morning breeze.
Can we move on, warlord? I am anxious to be on safe ground.
Not yet, said Caswellan.
I am concerned about the second force you mentioned, Bodrick.
Why did they split up, do you think?
To reform elsewhere. Why else?
Then where are they?
We've searched the west.
They could have returned to the south.
Or come north,
said Leofas.
My thoughts exactly, said Caswellan,
switching his gaze to the dark trees of Atta.
How many would you say were in the second force?
Leofas asked. Bodrigg shrugged.
It could be anything from 200 to 1,000. Not more, though.
Then for once we are not outnumbered, said Caswellan.
I think we'll camp here, and tonight we'll set fires. We know no force from the south can be on us before tomorrow past the noon.
Bodrigg and Leofas spread the word, and the women of the column cast around for firewood, though none approached the trees. Within the forest, Barsa waited patiently with his 750 archers, watching the Farlan make camp. Unlike his half-brother Ongist, Barsa was not a reckless man, though neither was he intuitive as his half-brother Drada. Barsa was simply a trained killer of men who relied on his experience more than his intellect. Experience told him the Farlan did not know of his presence. He had avoided their scouts and taken only the best of his men, breaking into small parties and heading north, reforming at the falls. He had been guessing as to the line of the clan march, and was secretly pleased at the accuracy of his guess. He had no idea where they were ultimately heading, for the north was a mystery to the Anir, save that men said the sea was not far off. And when he had received the message from Ongis saying the Palades were also racing north, he had acted at once, dispatching 3,000 to join his brother, and taking 800 with him to this place. It would please his father, and Barsa looked forward to basking in his praise. He could decimate the Farlan with his first volley. They would break and run, and his men would have their pick of the clan maidens. Sadly, they would then have to kill them. It was the one order that made no sense to Barsa. Always the Anir had taken captured women as house slaves and concubines, even wives. But in the mountains, Asbedag's orders had been specific. Kill all the clansmen, women, and children. An Anir forester crept to Barsa's side.
They are making camp. Should we attack tonight?
It was a thought that Barsa was loath to commit his men in the open, for the clans outnumbered him.
No, we'll wait for morning, as they enter.
The man nodded and moved silently back into the deeper darkness. Beyond the line of campfires flickering on the open ground, Caswellan silently led 1,000 warriors south, and then east, circling towards the blackness of Atta Forest. Once in the east, the Farlan split into 3 forces, one led by Caswellan, the others led by Leofas and Bordrigg. Armed only with short swords and hunting knives, the men entered the trees, moving silently forward. It was slow progress. The moon was bright above the mountains, but its light was diffused by the overhanging branches of the ancient oaks that made up the bulk of the forest. Every 3 or 4 steps, Caswellan closed his eyes, focusing on the sounds around him, listening for movements in the bushes ahead. The hoarse rasp of cloth on wood came to him, and Caswellan raised a hand. The men behind him stopped. He pointed to the bushes. A clansman crept forward with knife in hand. In the bushes, the Anir archer dozed, and died without waking as the razor-sharp hunting knife slid across his throat. Beyond him slept scores of warriors. With bright knives, the clansmen moved in among them, killing them as they slept. The night hunters moved on. Leofas and his group crept deep into the forest to the north, continuing their silent slaughter, before working their way down the western side, while Bordrig, reaching the northernmost point, turned south. An hour before dawn, a cry split the night silence as a clansman's blade slit open an Aenir throat. The man awoke as the knife cut into him, screaming a warning before dying as 6 inches of iron slashed through his neck. Bartha leapt to his feet, knowing instantly that he had been tricked. He bellowed a warning to those nearest and drew his sword. Aenir foresters ran to him, and then he saw the clansmen bearing down in the gloom. He glanced right and left. He had fewer than 100 men with him. But if the men of the clan had entered the forest, that left the women alone on open ground. Bartha turned and sprinted south. If they could only hack their way past the women and old men, they would be clear. The Aenir ran from the trees, and Bartha's heart sank. A line of women kneeling in the grass, bows bent. He threw himself to the ground as the shafts whistled home. A second volley hammered into their ranks, and the clansmen were upon them. Bartha leapt to his feet and parried a thrust from a short sword, sweeping a double-handed blow to the clansman's unprotected head and caving in the skull. A second man fell to his sword, and a third, as he roared his defiance at them. Then the clansmen fell back, and a warrior strode through their ranks. The man was tall, his long black hair tied at the nape of the neck, a trident beard giving him a sardonic appearance. His eyes were green, and in his hand he carried a short sword. Beside Bartha, the last of the Aenir foresters died with an arrow in his ribs. Bartha was not afraid of death. He had earned his place in the Grey God's Hall. Leaning on his sword, he grinned at the blood-drenched clansmen.
"Come on, then, Mountain Dung, I'll see your corpse before you see mine."
The clansmen stepped forward as Bartha's sword flashed in the air. He parried it, ducking beneath the swing to thrust at the Aenir's groin. Bartha leapt back, his blade plunging downwards. The clansmen blocked the blow, iron clashing on iron as the men circled. The Aenir had the advantage of the longsword, but the clansman moved swiftly, his green eyes probing for weaknesses in the Aenir's defence.
"Frightened, clansman," sneered Bartha.
The man did not reply, but leapt forward with a sword raised. Bartha slashed wildly. The man parried, then spun on his heel to hammer his elbow into Bartha's face. The Aenir staggered back, then felt the searing agony of a sword blade buried deep in his belly. An awful cry tore from his throat, and he pitched to the ground, writhing and straining to free the blade. Then the pain faded, washed from his body by the rushing blood. He rolled to his back, looking up at the sky above him, waiting to see the Valkyrie ride down for his soul. He wondered if Aspadag would mourn for him.
"I'll cut out his eyes," he heard someone say.
Bartha knew panic. He did not want to be blind in the Hall of Heroes.
"Leave him be,"
said the clansman who had cut him. Relief and release came together, and the light faded. Chapter 9. In the early morning sunlight, the clan women stripped the Aenir dead of all weapons and dispatched those warriors still clinging to life. Caswellan walked into the forest with many others of the attacking party, stopping at a fast-moving stream and removing his blood-covered clothes. The night's work had appalled the new warlord. More than 600 Aenir warriors had been butchered in their sleep. It was no way for a man to die. Caswellan stepped into the stream, shivering as the icy mountain water touched his skin. Swiftly he washed, then returned to the bank, sprawling out alongside Leofas and the young raven-haired warrior Onik, the finest quarterstaff fighter in the mountains.
"A fine night,"
said Leofas, grinning. Stripped of his clothing, the old warrior looked even more powerful. His barrel chest and muscular shoulders gave evidence of his great strength, yet his belly was flat and taut, the muscles of the solar plexus sharp and clean.
"It was a victory, anyway,"
said Caswellan wearily.
"You are a strange man, Caswellan," said Leofas,
sitting up and slapping the younger man between the shoulder blades.
These swine have come upon us with murder and reap, and now I sense you regret last night's slaughter.
I do regret it. I regret it was necessary.
Well, I enjoyed it, especially watching you gut back tall, son of a whore.
A group of clan women led by Meg came to the stream carrying clean clothes for the men. Casual undressed, and spotted Taliesin sitting on a fallen tree. The warlord joined him in the sunshine.
"There is a smell of death in this forest," said Taliesin. "It reeks of it."
The druid looked impossibly old. His face ashen, the skin dry. His cloak of feathers hung limply on his skeletal shoulders, the colours faded and dust-covered.
"But still, you did well, warlord."
Casualin sat beside the old man.
"Who are you, druid? What are you?" "I am a man, Casualin. No more, no less. I was a student centuries ago, and I joined the trek from the stars to see more of life. I wanted to learn the origins of man. The gates were a means to an end."
"And what are the origins of man?" Taliesin chuckled, his tired eyes showing a glint of humour.
"I don't know. I never will. My teacher was a great man. He knew the secrets of the stars, the mysteries of the planets, and the structures of the gates, and yet he never learned the origins. Together we journeyed and studied, and ever the great mystery eluded us. I sometimes fear the cosmic force I cannot see, and he laughs at me in my vanity."
"My teacher, Astley, became a mystic in a far land. It happened soon after the Prime Gate failed.
You see, he could never travel back far enough, anywhere, to find the first man. The gates would always be pushed back. Wherever we went, there was a man developed to some degree. Several hundred years ago, I developed a theory of my own, and I left Astley in the deserts of his world, and journeyed to a northern land, a highland kingdom. The people there were under threat, even as you are, and I led them to the Farland to watch them grow, and to see how they would develop. I thought the development would assist my studies."
"And did it?" asked Casualin.
"No. Man is a singularly irritating creature. All that happened was that I grew to love the people of the Farland. My studies were ruined anyway 200 years ago, and the last of my people wed into the race. He had no woman, you see, and every man needs companionship. I recruited many of their children, and so the order survives. But many of those now practicing the skill do not appreciate any longer the arts behind the machines. You, Casualin, are of my race. You are the great-grandson of the daughter of Nerist. A bright man was Nerist. He alone of all my pupils said we would never reopen the great gates. You cannot understand the awful sense of separation and loss we experienced when those gates closed. You see, what happened was an impossibility."
"Why should it be impossible?" asked Casualin.
"All things have a beginning and an ending."
"Indeed they do. But when you play with time, Casualin, you create circles. Think of this. Today you will see the last of the middle gates. Today, now, you will gaze upon it, and your people, our people, will pass through it. But tomorrow, let us say, the gate disappears. We are worried at first, but then we think, it was there yesterday. Therefore, we step through a lesser gate into yesterday. What should we find?"
"The other gate should once again be there," said Casualin.
"Aye, it should, for we saw it yesterday, pass through it. But that is the mystery, my boy. For when the great gates disappeared, they vanished throughout time. Impossible, for it does not correspond with reality.
You told me, said Caswellan, that magic was impossibility made reality. If that is true, there should be no problem accepting the reverse. What happened to your gates was simply reality, made impossibility. But who made it happen? Perhaps someone is studying you even as you study us, said Caswellan, smiling. Taliesin's eyes gleamed.
Astolay believed just such a thing. I do not.
At that moment, Galen entered the clearing, calling Caswellan's name. The warlord leapt to his feet, opening his arms as the young man ran to him. They stood there for several moments, hugging one another. Then Caswellan took hold of Galen's shoulders and gently pushed him away.
Now you're a sight to ease my mind, said Caswellan.
And you? Dave and I thought to find you cut to pieces by the Aeneir. We saw you from the peaks yonder.
Just for once we outthought them.
You look tired, and there is dried blood on your tunic. We've been chased over the mountains for 3 days.
But you came through. You taught me well.
Caswellan grinned.
Where is Deva?
Upstream, washing the grime from myself.
Then you do the same. Much as I am glad to see you, you smell like a dead fish. Away with you.
Caswellan watched the young man walk to the stream, and his eyes glowed with pride. Taliesin stood beside him.
He's a fine young man. A credit to you.
Credit to himself. You know, Taliesin, as I carried him on my back from the destruction of Artoris, I wondered if I was being foolish. His wounds were grievous, and he was all skin and bone anyway. My legs ached, and my back burned through every step. But I'm glad I didn't leave him.
He is tough,
agreed the druid.
Oracle did well to heal him.
Yes. I hope the old man survived the assault.
He did not,
said Taliesin.
Who'd you know?
Let us leave it that I know. He was a strong man, but vain.
That is not much of an epitaph, said Caswellan.
It is the best I can offer. Now, get the clan ready. We must cross the bridge before dusk.
Almost 6,000 people thronged the shoreline as the sun cleared noon. Silence fell upon them as a druid appeared on the island shore, some 40 yards across the foaming water. He tied a slender line to a sturdy pine, then looped the long coil over his shoulder and stepped out on the water. A gasp rose from the watchers, for the man was walking several feet above the torrent. After some 20 paces, he stopped, reaching down, and stroked the air in a vertical line by his feet. Then he looped the twine around the invisible post and walked on. This he did every 20 paces, and amazingly the twine hung in the air behind him. Slowly the man made his way to the waiting clan, stopping to tie the end of the twine to a small tree. Then he approached Taliesin and bowed.
Welcome, Lord. It is good to see you again. How many of the clan survived?
Just under 6,000, but there could be more hidden in the mountains.
And the Pallades?
No one knows, but the Hasten were crushed. I don't doubt many lesser clans were annihilated.
Sad news, Lord.
The druid, who seemed almost as ancient as Taliesin, turned to Caswellan.
You will instruct your people to hold on to the twine and follow it. There is no danger, and the path is wide enough to take a line of 5 men. Let them approach slowly, all children to be carried. If anyone falls, they are dead. They will be carried over Atafos within seconds. Instruct your people.
Caswellan was the first to cross, the clan filing slowly behind him. It was an uncanny sensation, placing weight upon solid air. He soon found it inadvisable to look down, for his sense of balance threatened to betray him. Behind him the clan followed in silence, and there were no mishaps. Once on the island, the clan spread out and pitched their camps. They found dried meat and fruit waiting for them, sacks of grain and oats, bags of salt, and huge tubs of honey, warm blankets, and soft hides. All the product of Kazulan's land that had so mysteriously disappeared the previous autumn. Kazulan himself called a war council, and they met in a cavern beneath Valen's highest hill. At the centre of the cavern was a long table of pine, around which were 50 chairs. These were soon filled. Kazulan took his place at the head of the table, flanked by Leofas and his sons Lennox and Lane. Beside them sat Gwalchmai and Galen, and beyond them Onik and the pick of the Farlan warriors. "Before we begin," Kazulan told them, "there is a matter to settle. It is our custom to elect our leaders. Most of the council were slain with Campbell in the valley. We here now constitute a new council. I offer myself as warlord, but if there is any here with a hankering to lead, let him speak." No one stirred. "It is accepted, then, that I lead the Farlan until this war is concluded?" "Of course it is, Kazulan, and do you think us fools?" said Leofas. "Very well. Then let us begin the real business of the day. How best can we hurt the enemy?" Asmodag gazed at the ruins that had been his son. Maggots writhed in the dead flesh, and the sharp beaks of crows had torn at the body. But still, it was recognizable as Ongist. In full armour, his helm in his hands, Asmodag stood before the tree, soaking in the sight, feeding his fury and his hatred. Behind him stood Drada and Tostig, and beyond them, 25,000 Aenir warriors. Asmodag felt no remorse, no sadness at the death of his child. He had not liked Ongist. He liked none of his offspring. But the boy had been his, blood of his blood. He could hear him praying for vengeance at the door of the Grey God's hall. Through his anger he felt frustration. How could he wreak vengeance upon the clans? Already his armies had slain 4,000. Many were the blood eagles decorating the countryside, but he wanted, needed more. The clans feared him now, but terror was his desire. He turned to Tostig.
"Fetch Agnetha from Asgard. Do it now."
The colour drained from the warrior's face, and he thought of asking his father to send another. But Asbodag's eyes were cold and distant, and Tostig knew from experience that he was on the edge of a killing frenzy. He nodded and backed away to his horse. Drada stood silently as his brother departed. He had scouted the hill where Magrig made his stand, and had received reports from the foresters as to the ploy the Palades used. It was a clever plan, but it would have failed against any captain less impetuous than Ongist. Magrig had gambled the lives of his people on one perilous venture, and he had succeeded. But it proved the measure of the man, and Drada knew he could best him when next they met. Two serious errors had been made by Magrig. On the night of the first attack, he had led his warriors on a suicidal charge to protect a few women and children, and now he had staked everything on one battle. He was obviously a man ruled by his heart. Drada hoped his success would make him bold. Asmodag stalked from the tree, and several warriors moved forward to cut down the body, preparing it for the funeral pyre on the hillside. Drada joined his father in the black tent at the base of the hill. Asmodag was drinking heavily, and Morgasa sat in the background, saying nothing.
"We will not catch the Palades before they link with the Farlan," said Drada.
"Good," said Asmodag. "I want them all together."
"Do you want to press on today?"
"No. We will wait for Agnetha."
Drada left his father and wandered through the camp to where his own tent had been pitched. Once inside, he stripped his armour and spread his blankets upon the ground. It was early yet, but weariness was upon him and he slept through the afternoon. He awoke to the smell of cooking meat. One of his carls brought him a platter of beef and some bread, and he joined the men outside. For the first time in many years, these fierce warriors were fighting not for gold, nor women, nor glory, but for land, and he sensed the difference in them.
"It will not be easy,"
said his carl captain Brigger, a swarthy black-haired veteran who had been Drada's first Aeneid tutor.
"Nothing worth having comes easy," Drada told him.
The man grinned.
"They fight well, these clansmen."
"Did you expect less?" Drada asked him.
"Not after the games."
"No."
Drada finished his meal and returned to his tent. Brigger watched him go. He had been Drada's carl captain for 5 years, and before that his swordmaster. He liked the boy. He was unlike his brothers. But then he had been brought up as a hostage in a foreign city, and upon his return was less Aeneid than foreigner. He was soft, and his learning sat heavily upon him. Asbadag had made him Brigger's charge. In the years that followed, Drada had learned of battle and death, horror and hate. But blood had run true, and he had become outwardly at least as much an Aeneid as his brothers. Only Brigger knew of the lack. Drada did not love war. He loved the planning of war. Brigger did not care. He sensed that Drada would one day rule the Aeneid, and he waited patiently for the day to come. The Aeneid warriors were anxious to push on, but Asbadag gave no orders to move. For 10 days they remained in camp, until on the morning of the 11th day, Tostig rode in alone, raiding his lathered mount outside his father's tent. Asbadag hauled him from the saddle, eyes blaring.
"Where is the witch-woman?" he stormed. "If you have failed me, I'll kill you. Your body will hang on the same tree as your brother."
"She is coming, father, I swear it. She refused to ride, said she would come in her own way."
Asbadag hauled him to his feet.
"She had better," he hissed.
At midnight, as the fires burned low, a bitter wind blew up, flashing sparks from the coals. Men shivered as dark clouds obscured the stars, and Asbadag, sitting alone before his tent, drew his red cloak around him. A shadow fell across him, and glancing up he saw the old woman standing before him leaning on a staff. She was as grotesque as ever, almost bald, the remaining greasy white patches of her hair hanging like serpents to her emaciated shoulders. Her teeth were broken and black, and her face adorned with wrinkled leathery skin, as if her skull had shrunk to half its size, leaving the flesh around it to sag monstrously. She wore a matted cloak of human scalps, and her tattered gown was said to have been made from the skins of flayed maidens. Asbadag believed it to be true.
"What do you want of me?"
she asked, her voice a sibilant hiss.
"Terror among the clans."
"You have brought terror to the clans. What do you want of me?"
"I want your sorcery."
"And what will you offer the Grey God?"
"Whatever he asks."
Her eyes gleamed.
"Whatever?"
"Is your hearing going, woman? Whatever?"
"100 virgins slain by midsummer."
"You shall have it."
"And 7 of your strongest men slain tonight."
"My men?"
"Yours. And I'll need your war dogs. Bring them to the woods in an hour."
Asbadag's carls roamed the camp until the 7 men had been chosen, bound and gagged. Together with the Aeneid lord's huntmaster Donick and his 7 hounds, they were taken to a circular clearing within the woods. Asbadag was waiting there with Drada, Morgasa, and Tostig. The woman Agneta sat close by on a round boulder. The bound men were forced to kneel before the woman, and she waved away Asbadag's carls, who returned, relieved, to the camp. Agneta called Donick forward, ordering him to set each dog before a bound man. He did so, then ran back to his blankets and the guttering fire behind Asbadag's tent. In the clearing, The kneeling men were sweating freely as they stared into the eyes of Asbadag's hounds. Agneta glanced at the Aenea lord and nodded.
"Kill!"
he shouted. The hounds lunged forward, ripping at the exposed throats before them. Agneta ran along the line of dying men, hurling a grey misty powder over them and chanting. One by one the dogs sank to the earth, their teeth embedded in the flesh of the slain men. The witch-woman lifted her arms to the night sky, screaming the name of the grey god over and over again.
"Vartan! Vartan! Vartan!"
By her feet, the hounds began to writhe and swell, while the Aenea corpses twisted and shriveled. Morgasa turned away. Drada swallowed hard, flicking a glance at his father. Asbadag was grinning. Tostig squeezed shut his eyes. Within seconds, the dead warriors were bone-filled husks, while the hounds had grown to treble their size. Their front paws had stretched into taloned fingers, and their dark fur-covered forms parodied men. Long, muscular legs, deep, powerful chests, and round heads ending in elongated maws and sharp fangs. Agneta danced around them, bidding them rise. Releasing the empty husks, the beasts pushed themselves to their feet, red eyes scanning the clearing. Their gaze fell upon Asbadag, and their howling rent the night. Tostig stepped backward in terror and fell. Morgasa gripped Drada's arm.
"Is this what you wanted, Asbadag?" said Agneta.
"Yes.
Once unleashed, they can never be brought back. They will follow no one. They are created out of hate, and they will kill any man they find, be he Aenea or clan. Is this what you want?"
"Yes, curse you. Just send them north."
"They will go where they will, but I will send them north. Have you done with me now?"
"I have."
"Remember your promise, Asbadag. 100 maidens by midsummer, or the werehounds will hunt you."
"Don't threaten me, hag!"
thundered Asbadag. The woman cackled and turned to the silent beasts. Lifting her arm, she pointed north, and the ghastly pack loped away into the darkness. Asbadag walked forward, pushing his boot against a shriveled corpse. A dried bone split the skin and fell to the grass. He shook his head and began to laugh. Agneta stopped him, placing her bony hand upon his arm.
"What is so amusing?"
"This,"
he answered, pushing the corpse once more.
"This was Anias, son of my brother Castor. Only yesterday I told him he was empty-headed. Now his body matches his head."
Drada approached Agneta.
"How can those things live?"
"In the same way as you, Lord Drada. They breathe and they eat. It is an old spell, and a fine one, taught to me by an Aenea shaman in another age."
"But what are they now, hounds or men?"
"They are both and neither."
"Do they have souls?"
"Do you?"
"Not any more," said Drada, gazing down at the corpses.
The pack made their first kill that night, drifting silently through the pine forests in the northwest. The leader's head came up, nostrils flaring in the breeze. His red eyes turned to the northeast, and he led the group deeper into the trees. A young Hasten clansman and his two daughters were hidden in a cave. Having escaped the assault on their valley, they had met a Farland scout, who told them to head for Valon. The clansman travelled by night, carrying his youngest child, a girl of 6 years. His other daughter was 11, and she walked beside them. On this night, exhausted and hungry,
They had made an early camp in the pine woods, after spotting the Aenir army to the south. The man had fallen into a light sleep when the werebeast struck, and he died without a struggle, his eyes flaring open to see wide jaws lined with fangs flashing towards his face. He had no time to scream. His elder daughter, Jaka, took hold of her little sister and sped from the cave, only for talons to lance into her back, dragging her to a stop. In the last moment of her young life, Jaka hurled her sister into the undergrowth. The child screamed as she crashed through the bushes. Then she was up and running, the awful sound of howling echoing behind her. For an hour or more the beasts fed. Then they slept by the remains of their kill. At dawn they left the cave, their hunger not totally appeased. The leader dropped to all fours, sniffing at the earth around the cave. His head came up as the breeze shifted, and they set off in pursuit of the child. Margrig was angry. An hour before he had been furious. Caswellan had calmly told him that the clans would fight as one, and the one would be led by Caswellan. Margrig could not believe his ears. The two men had been alone in a tiny cell, the bedchamber of a druid. Caswellan sat beside Margrig on the narrow cot, outlining his plans.
"I have plans of my own," said the Paladese chieftain.
Caswellan had been dreading this moment, and he took a deep breath.
"I know it's hard for you, but think about it deeply. The death toll among the clans has been enormous. I have perhaps 4,000 fighting men. You have 800. Even together, we are no match for one fighting wing of the Aenir army."
"I accept that, Caswellan. But why should you lead? What experience do you offer? Great gods, man. You've turned down responsibility all your life. Granted, you've led us here and our women and children are safe. But to lead in war calls for more than that."
"It calls for a cool head," said Caswellan.
Magrid grunted.
"You'll not lead the Paladins."
"Let me make this clear to you. You are on Farlan land, under the protection of the Farlan clan. If you do not accept me, then I will require you and all your people to leave tomorrow."
"And where would we go?"
"Wherever you choose. Those that remain will follow me, without question."
"You would really do this thing? Turn out women and children to be slaughtered by the Aenir?"
"I would."
"What have you become, Caswellan? I mean, I've always liked you, boy. You were different, yes, but you were a clansman. Now you sit here and calmly say you would sacrifice my people for your ambition."
"No, that is what you are saying," Caswellan told him.
"During the games, you made an agreement with Larrick that you would support him in any war as long as you became warlord. You reached that decision on the grounds that your men outnumbered the Hasten. That argument should surely still apply, can you not see it? If I were to agree that you lead, then most of the Farlan men would quit and go. They would not follow you. You think the Paladins would follow you?"
"Yes."
"Why? What makes you so different?"
"I am your son by law. For I wed your daughter. That gives me the rights of a Paladese warrior. They cannot argue."
"All right," said Magrig at last. "I will follow you, but only as long as I think you are right."
"No," said Caswellan. "You will take my hand and swear allegiance to me as warlord. You will offer me your life, as your carls have done for you."
"Never."
"Then prepare your people to move."
Magrick had stormed from the room, seeking Intosh, and together they walked among the trees of Valon, avoiding the dark entrance to the druid's hall. Magrick emptied himself of fury, his words tumbling over one another as he poured scorn on his son-in-law, the Farlan, the druids, and the one angry god for bringing him to this pass.
Intosh remained silent, merely walking beside his lord and absorbing his words. Finally exhausted, Magrick stopped and sat by the water's edge, staring into the torrent.
"Well, what do you think?"
he asked.
"Of what?"
answered the swordsman.
"Where can we go?"
"There is nowhere."
"We could go north,"
said Magrig.
And find the Dunnels, the Loda, and the Sea Clans.
Then what do you suggest?
Agree to serve Caswellon.
Are you serious?
He has done well.
I know that, and all credit to him. But to serve my own son-in-law.
He has the power,
said Intosh, shrugging.
It makes sense.
He demanded I swear the vassal oath.
You would have done the same.
That's not the point,
snapped Magrig.
No, Hunt Lord.
An hour later, Magrig swore the vassal oath and was amazed his tongue did not fall out. That same afternoon, Caswellan and Magrig led the women and children of the Palades into the Druid's Hall entrance and down into the broad underground chamber housing the middle gate. Magrig blinked. At the end of the hall was a black marble archway. Yesterday, a solid wall of stone had stretched between the pillars. Now, that wall was gone, and the Palades Hunt Lord gazed down on the first valley of the Farlan, where already men and women were pitching tents and felling trees for shelter. The archway was twice the height of a man, and 10 paces across. The two men stood in the gateway looking down on the valley. Within paces of them, a tall pine was waving in the breeze, but no breath of wind touched their faces.
"Where are the Aenir?"
asked Magrick, as his people bunched behind him looking down in wonder.
"That is the Farlan 10,000 years ago," said Caswellan.
Magrick's eyes widened.
"This is sorcery, then?"
"It most certainly is," Caswellan told him. Magrick stepped through the gateway, flinching as rushing colours blinded him momentarily. Caswellan walked through behind him, waving the women to follow. On the other side, the breeze was cool, the sunlight warm and welcoming.
"That is not possible,"
whispered Magrig, watching his people materialise from the air. From this side there was no sign of the gate, only the rolling green countryside. Caswellan led the Palades down into the meadow where Leofas was supervising the building work.
"I'm glad to see he survived," said Magrig. "He always was the best of the Farlan."
The old warrior grinned as he saw Magrig, stepping forward to grip the Hunt Lord by the hand.
"So, you got here, you dog,"
said Leofas.
"Did you expect a few lowlanders to stop me?" "Certainly not. I expected you to chase the swine from our lands, leaving nothing for the Farland to do."
"I was tempted,"
said Magrig, with a broad grin. Caswellan left the men talking and sought out Galen. He found him chatting to Deva by the river's edge. Apologizing for disturbing them, Caswellan led Galen up into the timberline, and they sat beneath the pines.
"I want you to do something for me," said Caswellan. "But it is hazardous."
"Name it," said Galen.
"Don't make hasty judgments. I want you to take some men and head back into the Hasten, gathering as many warriors as you can. I want you to bring them to Axter Glen in 3 weeks."
"Why the Glen?
It is there we will tackle the Aenir."
"But that is open ground."
"I know. Have faith in me. I am hoping there will be upwards of 1,000 clansmen still in hiding. I have sent messages to the Dunnilds, the Loda, and many other smaller clans, but I don't know if they will come to our aid. We must get more men. You must find them."
"I'll do the best I can."
"I know that, Galen."
"Why me?"
"Because you are known as an outsider. You are accepted within the Farland, there is no doubt about that. But similarly, ye are not Farlan. The Hasten may follow you."
"Even if I did add 1,000 to our army, we would still be outnumbered 5 to 1, and on open ground."
"I am also going on a journey,"
said Caswellan.
"If it is successful, we will have another ally."
"Where will you go?"
"Through the gate. I'm seeking help from the Queen beyond."
Galen shivered. You mean the daughter of the woman who saved us from the beast? No, the woman herself. She is dead. As we sit here in the